motivating him to call for backup before taking action. She dared not wait and hope that he'd have second thoughts, swing around her, and go on his way. Better to deal with one cop than two or three. She let the Ford stray into the faster lane, then yanked it sharply back, angling off the highway, onto the shoulder. The right front bumper knocked hard against the guardrail, and the car jolted to a halt. She shifted into park, but left the engine running. The patrol car eased off the pavement and halted 8 or 10 feet behind her. Jane thrust a hand into the bag of cookies, broke one of the big treats in half, and stuffed it into her mouth. She plucked the thermos cup from the cup holder and filled her mouth with coffee. When highway patrolmen pulled you over, they didn't like you getting out of the vehicle until they told you to do so. She at once stepped out of the Ford, leaving the door open. When she saw that he was watching from behind the wheel, she bent over and spewed part of the thick mush of cookie and coffee onto the ground. She spouted the last of the soupy mess and gagged and wiped at her mouth with her coat sleeve. She turned and put her left hand on the Ford as if for support and moved toward the back of the vehicle. The cruiser's light bar began flashing now, warning westbound traffic out of the slow lane. She pretended to change her mind about approaching the patrol car, instead climbed into the back seat of the Ford and left that door standing open too. If the make of the car and the muddied plate gave the trooper one idea from which he'd imagined a scenario, she needed to throw a curve into the storyline that he foresaw and get him to follow her script instead. Lying prone on the seat, she heard him get out of his car. A moment later, he spoke to her through the open door.
"You having a problem, ma'am?"
His right hand would be on the grip of his weapon. Face down, head away from him, she spoke with a slur and a hint of Texas, but strove not to exaggerate.
"Go away and let me sleep." "You need to sit up and have a little talk with me, ma'am."
"You'll just be mean to me. Let me sleep some."
"Don't make this any harder on yourself than it has to be. You hear me now?"
"I don't hear nobody's."
He said something, but an 18-wheeler went by and masked his words in engine roar and the rumble of rubber on asphalt. The slipstream of the big truck washed through the open door, and Jane said,
"Oh, shit. Gonna puke again."
She scrambled across the seat and threw open the back door on the passenger side.
"Hey, hey, hey," the trooper said. "You just wait there."
She got out of the car and bent forward and stood with her back to him and made retching noises. She stumbled sideways, then put her back to the car and slid down and sat on the ground. He wouldn't like leaving both port side doors open. They were traffic hazards. He wouldn't want to leave the engine running, but he couldn't risk dealing with any of that. When he came around the back of the Ford, gravel stone crunching under his shoes, he was probably following protocol, his right hand on his gun, or maybe he had even taken the precaution of drawing the weapon. She sat with legs splayed and head hung. She didn't look up at him, because drunks who avoided eye contact were generally much less belligerent than those who tried to stare you down.
"Come on now, lady," he said. "You don't want to be resisting an officer of the law."
She said, "Mr. Man, you accepted Jesus?"
"Have I accepted Jesus?" "Yes, ma'am, I guess I have. So you've nothing to fear by working with me here."
"I accepted Jesus," she said, "but he's done gone all mad at me, and he's got every damn right to be."
"Jesus doesn't get mad, ma'am. He wants you to cooperate here, wants you to get up and talk to me now."
"Does he?" "Yeah, but I can't up my own self."
"You fixin' to be sick again?"
She finally tilted her head back and looked up at him, wearing as sorrowful an expression as she could manage.
"I wished I could puke some more, but seems I can't."
Face flushed with sunset light, He was handsome, maybe 30. A recruiting poster for the Texas Highway Patrol in his dark tan uniform with blue stripes and red piping on the pant legs, blue and red epaulets on his shirt, felt cowboy hat, black patent leather gun belt with a silver buckle, his pistol in its holster.
"Why don't you take my hand here and get up from there?"
"Mr. Man, you figuring on being mean to me?"
"You don't need mean. You need soberin'. Come on now."
She hated to do this to him. He was young enough to have a little trust left in him, at least for pitiable drunk women, if for no one else. Therefore, he wasn't handling this strictly by the book. Jane didn't like being the one who might knock enduring cynicism into him. She took his hand, pretending awkwardness as she got up. Maybe he caught a glimpse of the shoulder rig under her coat, or maybe he realized that he didn't smell either alcohol or vomit. But for whatever reason, he said,
"Oh, shit."
He might have successfully pulled away from her if she hadn't already unclipped the handheld taser from her belt. She buzzed him through his uniform shirt, and he dropped beside the car, as if every hinged joint became unhinged and every ball and socket separated, his cowboy hat slipping off and rolling against the guardrail. Jane bent down and tasered him again, this time on the neck. She pulled the small plastic bottle from an inner coat pocket and sprayed his nose and mouth with chloroform. He stopped spasming and fell unconscious. She recovered his hat and tilted it over his face to trap some of the fumes, leaving half his mouth and his dimpled chin exposed. Chapter 30. Heart rate elevated only slightly, breathing deep and slow. Jane had no reason for fear. The worst that could have happened didn't happen, and everything would move along now from one minor crisis to another, all of them manageable, until she was out of Texas, barring another nasty twist of Luck's dagger. The sky shading from midnight blue in the east to azure and gold in the west, the tattered strips of cloud blazing like flags afire, the land as red as some apocalyptic battlefield, elongated shadows strewn like wounded and dying combatants. The Ford blocked the fallen officer from view. Passing traffic at that hour and in that remoteness consisted mostly of truckers and others driving to demanding schedules with no time for curiosity. Casual travelers were holed up for the night, loath to venture into the thinly populated wasteland after dark. Nevertheless, the tableau of police car and stopped Ford with no trooper visible was peculiar enough to inspire some fearless Samaritan to stop to assist. In addition to the holster and pistol, the trooper's gun belt was equipped with spare magazine pouches and a mace holder and a handcuff case. She took the handcuffs. He was too big to move any great distance. She dragged him a couple feet until she was able to lift his right arm and cuff him to the front passenger door handle of the Ford. When she checked his breathing, he was having no respiratory difficulty, so she spritzed him lightly with more chloroform and canted the hat on his face. She went around to the open driver's door and reached inside and switched off the engine and took the keys. She closed the door as an 18-wheeler rolled past, its windy wake peppering her with grit and dust and fumes. She went to the open rear door and got into the back seat and fished the plastic-wrapped bundles of cash and gold coins from under the front seats. She didn't know what the coins were worth, but the money that she had taken from Bertold Schenck's house in Napa more than 10 days earlier amounted to $160,000 in $100 bills. There was a satisfaction in knowing that the inventor of the brain implant was in part paying for her assault against the new world order of which he had dreamed. After closing the back door, she went around to the tailgate and opened it. She shoved the plastic-wrapped cash into the tote and, moving efficiently but without appearing to hurry, she took it to the patrol car and placed it on the front seat. The key was in the ignition, Engine running. Police radio alive with a dispatcher's voice that didn't sound alarmed. In a second trip, Jane transferred her two suitcases, putting them in the back of the black and white. Most of the passing drivers were not sufficiently interested to cut their speed and look her over. Those few who slowed for a moment speeded up again, probably reminding themselves that in the current social climate, those who came to the defense of the police were likely to be defamed or worse. Welcome to the uncivil society. One of those who felt guilty about not stopping might phone the highway patrol, however, or perhaps use a CB radio to start a line of chatter about what he had seen. She wasn't allowing herself to hear a clock ticking, but one was ticking, nonetheless. At the trooper's side again, she took his pulse and listened to his breathing, and decided that she could leave him as he was. The highly volatile chloroform had mostly evaporated from his face. Even with the hat still trapping some fumes, he would wake in 10 minutes or so. She disliked taking his star-in-a-wheel badge, but she took it anyway. She would not disarm him and leave him helpless. She left his Sig Sauer P320 in the holster, but she took the Ford key from one of her jacket pockets and pitched it across the guardrail into the descending darkness, denying him the use of her car. She walked back to the Dodge Charger, black flanks, white hood and roof and trunk lid, Texas Highway Patrol seal on the front doors, and settled in behind the steering wheel. She quickly looked over the controls, including the Panasonic Toughbook computer terminal and digital citation printer. When a long gap in traffic opened behind her, she pulled onto the highway and headed west. She switched on both the roof-mounted light bar and the siren. Acceleration was excellent. The speedometer registered 100 in mere seconds. Part 6. The Ninth Floor. Chapter 1. Jane, at 110 miles per hour and accelerating. Out there, in the timeless dark, in the land of countless peoples extending so far back in time that they had no names, but instead identified their tribes with icons. Out there in the baked plains and in the shallow washes where grew thin grass as brittle as dead men's hair. On the volcanic slopes where little thrived but waxy candelia. Where now there were no faintest lights and the stars found nothing to reflect them. Even that primal emptiness lay under the watch of cameras in orbit, the robotic eyes of satellites, and if there was any hope of freedom in the future, it resided in the ironic fact that the highly perfected technology of this age was operated by fallible human beings, who might never quite control it for maximum oppression, and would find themselves exposed by white-hat hackers who could mine the opposition's data for veins of criminality and scandal. Through that immense darkness, Jane raced in a blazon of red, white, blue, fleeting cascades of color washing across the vehicles that she passed, though the night-mantled land beyond the highway remained resistant to the dazzle of the light bar. She didn't know if the Texas Highway Patrol required periodic contact between each patrol officer and a dispatcher to ensure that its troopers were safe and on the beat. Neither did she know if they actively tracked every black and white by GPS and assigned someone periodically to review a computer graphic of the current whereabouts of the units within a particular county or jurisdiction. What she didn't know would get her captured or killed. If she pushed the Dodge Charger to 120 and put out of her mind the consequence of a blown tire, she would still never make the Texas border north of El Paso before the THP was on her tail and blocking the way ahead. Even at this speed, she'd need more than 4 hours to get there, and although she could shave an hour or more off that by switching to U.S. Highway 285 at Stockton and trying to cross into New Mexico south of Malaga, There was the matter of fuel. If she stopped to gas up, she might as well surrender. After 20 minutes, when she'd put about 40 miles between herself and the Ford to which the trooper was cuffed, she killed the siren and doused the light bar and eased off the accelerator, letting her speed fall to 65. She kept to the right-hand lane. She knew what she needed to do next, but she couldn't risk doing it alongside the interstate in full view of traffic. She wouldn't take a chance that someone might see where she had gone when she abandoned the patrol car. Shortly before she had halved her speed, she'd seen a sign for a rest stop 6 miles ahead. It was her best hope, as long as it wasn't too much in use. She switched off the car's on-duty camera. Whether it might be another twist of bad luck or a turn for the better, less than a quarter mile from the rest stop, as she cruised behind a white Mercedes E350, the driver signaled a right turn and slowed for the exit. Maybe he needed to use the facilities, or was just nervous about a cop hanging behind him. He appeared to be alone in the car, unless someone might be lying on the back seat. Jane left the interstate in his wake and switched on the light bar, though not the siren. He did the right thing, not stopping in the single lane, but following it to the parking area, where there were, at the moment, no other vehicles. The concrete block structure housing the lavatories featured a lamp above each of two doors and four pathway lamps, but in these lonely environs, it looked less like a station offering relief than like somewhere you went to die by a violent hand. Meant to soften the look of the place, beds of agave rose like clusters of spiny talons, each topped with a wicked dark needle, and failed in their purpose. If there were any cameras associated with the rest stop, she didn't think there were. The lighting was too poor to make them of much value. She parked behind and to one side of the Mercedes and switched off the headlights so that she wouldn't be fully revealed by their backwash when she got out. She left on the throbbing light bar for the confusion it provided, and so the driver wouldn't freak that the cruiser had gone dark. She got out and went to the Mercedes as the driver's door window purred down. She thrust the classic star-in-a-wheel badge toward the driver just to keep him unsettled, and then pointed her Colt 45 at him. "Get out of the car." He might have been in his late 70s. Receding white hair, jug ears, rubbery features that gravity pulled into a weary clown face. Although he wasn't fat, in his youth, he might have had a merry look, a bantamweight Santa.
"You're not the police," he said.
"Besides not being the police, I'm not very damn patient either. Get out of the car." She backed off to avoid the opening door and held the Colt in a two-hand grip, arms locked, because even as benign as he looked, he could be dangerous. The most unlikely people were capable of the most atrocious acts in a world where progress flushed away not just the leaden encumbrances of the past, but also its valuable lessons. Out of the car, the guy stood about 5'7", weighed maybe 140 pounds. Black and white Converse sneakers, breezy cut pale gray chinos, Hawaiian shirt with blue palm trees against a golden background, a colorful drink bead bracelet around one wrist. He looked like a retired Brooklyn accountant trying to reinvent himself as a Jimmy Buffett parrot head.
"Are you going to kill me?"
he asked, though he didn't seem to be afraid. "That's not the plan," she said, concerned that a death threat might give him a heart attack. "But I'll hurt you bad if you screw with me. I need a driver."
"I'm a good driver. I've been driving 65 years.
You're good enough. There's some luggage in the patrol car. Get your ass in gear and move it to the Mercedes."
"Why can't you move it?"
"I need to keep the gun on you." He shrugged.
"I guess you need to think you do."
"Hurry up, damn it." He took one of the suitcases out of the back seat of the Dodge.
"This is heavy, you know."
He required both hands to lift the case by its handle, and he crabbed sideways to his sedan as if hauling a half-ton of lead.
Go, no, I'd have a passenger with luggage. The trunk is full of mine. You think the back seat?
Just do it. While he wrestled the second suitcase out of the patrol car, Jane kept one eye on him as she turned off the light bar and killed the engine. She snared the tote on the front seat and put it in the Mercedes. Age seemed to have withered his arms to those of a 9-year-old boy.
Is this heavy or what? From this, a person could die.
She holstered her pistol. Give me that. She took the bag from him and swung it into the back of the Mercedes and slammed the door.
You must work out a lot, he said.
You have a weapon in the car? Don't lie to me. Everyone who lies to me regrets it.
I've got a prostate pillow.
A what?
A foam pillow with a hole in the middle.
How the hell is that a weapon?
I could maybe get it around your neck and twist.
Are you for real?
I used to be.
Though she felt ludicrous doing it, she drew her Colt 45 again. Get in the car, old man. Move. Move. Move! He climbed in behind the wheel, boosted by the prostate pillow, and Jane settled in the passenger seat, holding the pistol in her right hand, pointing it at him. He started the car and turned on the headlamps.
Should I know where we're going?
Back onto I-10. West.
That's where I was already.
As he followed the service lane to the highway, he said,
Not that I should give you ideas, but why not take my car and just leave me back there?
You're my driver, but you're also my cover. They might be looking for a woman alone. Now we're two. Any cop stops us, I'm your daughter.
What are you, 20?
What does it matter?
I'm 81. Better you be my granddaughter.
All right, I'm your granddaughter.
What's your name?
Never mind what my name is.
A policeman asks. I shouldn't know my granddaughter's name.
Okay, you're right. It's Alice. On the interstate, he puttered along at 10 miles under the limit, and she told him to drive 10 miles over. Half the traffic will be passing you at 10 over. Cops will target them. We can risk the extra speed. He obeyed her, but he said,
You're in an awful hurry.
You can't imagine.
What happened to that policeman you had his car?
I didn't kill him.
I didn't think kill. Not such a pretty girl like you.
What? You're coming on to me?
Don't be so jumpy already. I haven't come on to anyone in 60 years. How far west?
Past El Paso into New Mexico.
I'm going there anyway, and then on to Scottsdale.
So maybe you can take me all the way to Nogales.
Such a long run with nothing but gas stops. You'll have to do some driving.
What? While you hold the gun on me? Just keep your speed up. After a brief silence, he said,
My name's Bernard Rigowitz. You can call me Grandpa Bernie.
She sighed. This is not going to end well.
Negative thinking brings negative results, he advised.
As they passed Sonora, she saw that the fuel tank was more than 3/4 full. He must have filled up in Junction. They would easily make Fort Stockton, perhaps even Van Horn, before they would need to refuel, and then it would be a smooth glide into New Mexico, unless there was a roadblock at the state line. Or before. She said, What are you doing at your age, driving territory this lonely at night?
I like to sleep days. Drive the dark. It's soothing. Have to do it alone now since I lost Miriam. Married 61 years. From when we were 19. Never apart one day.
Jane said, Shit.
It's true. Whether a person believes it or not. Never apart one day until a year ago.
I'm sure it's true, she said. But if I have to be holding some poor son of a bitch at gunpoint, why does it have to be an 81-year-old grieving widower
Don't worry about it, Alice. You should forgive me if this sounds schmaltzy, but you've brought some color into a year of gray.
Yeah, but I could get you killed. I don't want that.
Negative thinking brings negative results, he reminded her.
Chapter 2. The McDonald's in Lake Forest was like no McDonald's anywhere else. No golden arches, no tacky plastic, a marble fireplace, nice furniture, classical music on the sound system. It was as if they had gone to dinner in a strange world parallel to the one in which they lived. Not that the one in which they lived hadn't gotten strange enough lately. Throughout dinner, Twyla was Twyla, at least to the casual eye and ear. Mother didn't seem to notice anything wrong with her older daughter, but Jolie was aware of subtle differences between this girl and the sister with whom she'd grown up. This Twyla wasn't as witty, wasn't as light-hearted, wasn't as present. A few times during dinner, Jolie nearly blurted out, "Mother, can't you tell she's gone blurry at the edges? She's on drugs. She injects herself. We need to have an intervention right now." But she didn't do it. And she didn't know why she didn't do it until they ordered dessert, when she realized that she owed Twyla a frank one-on-one before going to their mother. They'd been as close as muffins in a basket until Twyla went off to college, and even after that, when they saw each other, it was as if no time passed since their last get-together. Until now. Maybe Twyla could explain herself. Fat chance. There were no good reasons for addiction, only justifications. That's what Daddy said. Still, she owed Twyla some consideration before blowing the whistle on her. It wasn't a good night for family drama and the sleeplessness that would follow a confrontation. They needed to rise early in the morning. Mother and Daddy had talked on their disposable phones. He wanted them to drive to Indianapolis, which would take maybe 3.5 hours if they got out ahead of the Chicago morning rush. Mother was supposed to call Daddy when they were in Indianapolis, as soon as they transitioned from I-65 to I-465. By then, he would know where they should go for someone to meet them. Not Daddy. Someone Daddy trusted. It was all uber mysterious. But then, what wasn't these days? Maybe it was better to postpone confronting Twyla until the whole family could be together again. While Twyla waited for their dessert, Mother wondered if the restrooms were as different from other McDonald's restrooms as everything else was different, and Jolie wondered too, so they went to have a look. Jolie hoped there would be something in the women's room to lighten her mood, such as an open sterling silver box worth $10,000 in which paper towels were stacked, bearing Ronald McDonald's initials. But it wasn't radically different from other McDonald's restrooms, at least not in any way that elicited a laugh. After they ate dessert, Mother was paying the check when Jolie suddenly realized that the drugs she'd seen in her sister's suitcase might not be drugs. Well, they were certainly drugs, but they might be prescription drugs, and entirely legitimate. Twyla might have a serious health problem that required her to self-inject an exotic medication that had to be kept chilled in a dry ice case. Jolie's heart sank. It really did, like a stone in her breast, at the thought that Twyla might be terminal, or, if not terminal, stricken with some terrible ailment that would profoundly affect her life. Because they needed their sleep, there would be no confrontation tonight. But Jolie could perhaps probe subtly, ask a few innocuous questions, and see how Twyla reacted. If she didn't do at least that much, if she didn't get some sense of whether her sister's condition was serious or not, she wouldn't sleep anyway. Chapter 3. The way Bernie Rigowitz told it, he and Miriam had never flown anywhere because he was afraid of flying, but they'd explored 49 states by car, some of them often. And he had never been to a state he didn't want to see again, with the possible exception of North Dakota, even though Louis L'Amour had been born there. He and Miriam had been blessed with one child, Nasia, who was now 52 and living in Scottsdale with her husband, a nice boy named Segev. They wanted Bernie to come live with them, but though he loved them, he refused to entertain the idea. For one thing, they badly wanted him to stop driving from one coast to the other, all alone at his age. He would never do that, because Miriam wasn't lying in a cold grave in New York. No, she was out there, everywhere the two of them had ever gone, and being on the road was being with Miriam. Jane fell in love with Grandpa Bernie somewhere east of Fort Stockton, shortly before they stopped there to refuel at 9:45. She pumped the gas, and he paid with his credit card, and they went into the restaurant together to get takeout chili dogs, which they ate while on the road, with three layers of paper napkins on their laps to catch what he called the drib-drabs. The roadblock, or one of them, had been established 46 miles west of Fort Stockton, just before exit 212 to Saragossa. They had long ago finished the chili dogs, but they were eating redskin peanuts and drinking Diet Mountain Dew when Bernie put down his window for the THP trooper and asked if the problem was terrorists. He was glad to hear it wasn't terrorists and produced his driver's license and introduced his granddaughter, Alice, and told the officer that he looked remarkably like Bernie's brother, Lev. But of course, when Lev was maybe 35, which was 40 years ago. When they had been allowed through the checkpoint and were rolling once more, Jane said, "Did he actually look anything like your brother, Lev?"
"I don't have a brother, Lev," Bernie said. "I have a brother, Shem. But I couldn't use his name, 'cause it wouldn't surprise me if a cop knew from Shem Rigowitz."
"I can see why Miriam wanted to drive everywhere with you."
"You travel well yourself, missy, and you played Alice just right. A person might think you've had a lot of practice at this."
"I wish I didn't."
"By the way, that's a fine wig. The trooper never spotted it."
"I'm not wearing a wig," Jane lied.
"Missy, I made my money from wigs, both human hair and the finest synthetic fibers. Elegant Weave, that was the company name, sold wigs up and down the eastern seaboard, in 14 states and the District of Columbia. You can't fool me about wigs."
"Sorry for trying. I bought this one and four others from people who also sell false ID, driver's licenses, contacts that change your eye color, and probably other stuff I don't want to think about."
"Next time you see them, you tell them Bernie Rigowitz of Elegant Weave says they've got first-class product."
They passed a couple miles in silence, drinking the last of the Mountain Dew, before Jane said, "You haven't asked what I'm running from."
"Haven't? And won't, Bubba. I don't want to be disappointed if it's not as glamorous as I imagine."
Chapter 4. In their room at the Deer Path Inn, the sisters took turns using the bathroom. Jolie was already settled in bed, sitting up against the headboard. When Twyla appeared in silky white pajamas with a reproduction of an Andy Warhol soup can on the blouse. As her sister pulled back the covers on her side of the queen-size bed, Jolie said, "Can I ask you something? And you promise to be straight as a ruler with me?" "When have I ever not been straight with you?" "So, is something wrong in your life?" Getting into bed, Twyla sighed and said, "Charles isn't married, and I'm not pregnant." "I don't mean any of that." Twyla frowned. "Then what do you mean?" "You're not sick or anything?"
"Do I look sick? I think I look pretty darn good."
"Fabulous. I hope I look as good when I'm your advanced age."
"I doubt you will," Twyla said.
"I think I've got more of mother's genes and you've got more of daddy's." That was like the old Twyla. Jolie said, "Well, I just worry about you, that's all, out there in Boston. Now you sound like Daddy, Boston half a world away. So, you're all right? I've never been better. Go to sleep, Joe. A long day tomorrow. Instead of turning off the nightstand lamp, Twyla clicked it to a dimmer setting. She had a magazine.
You're not turning in? Jolie asked.
I won't keep you awake. I just want to read this article I didn't finish on the plane. Jolie slid down from the headboard and turned on her left side, her back to Twyla. She waited to hear a page being turned. The sound didn't come. Twyla was not a slow reader. Jolie waited for the page. Waiting, she fell asleep. Chapter 5. Bernie had slept most of the day, with the intention of driving through the soothing night with memories of Miriam. Jane had been on the move since 4:20 this morning, when she'd awakened in the motel in Ardmore, Oklahoma. By 11:35 Thursday night, as they reached Van Horn, Texas, she couldn't stop yawning.
Sleep. Sleep, Bernie said. An owl should be as awake as me. If I need you, I'll give a shout.
If it turned out Jane couldn't trust him, then her intuition was not worth beans anymore, and she was as good as finished anyway. She powered the back of her seat to a slant and closed her eyes. He said,
Can you sleep to some music?
Right now, I could sleep to artillery fire.
I'll keep it soft.
He fiddled with the CD controls, and when the music came on, Jane said, Lawrence Welk and his Champagne Orchestra. You like big band music? Swing?
I don't know one big band from another.
Duke Ellington, Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman. Great stuff.
Miriam liked to watch Lawrence Welk on TV way back when. I know his music is corny.
It is what it is. Nothing to be ashamed of. He gave people what they wanted. He just never stretched, never had an edge.
You know music?
She almost said, I can rock a piano. She was too tired to trust herself in conversation. Good night, Grandpa. Her dreams were not unpleasant, with bubbles in them. When she woke after an hour or so to Welk in full mellow mode with apple blossom time, the Mercedes wasn't in motion. She sat up, alarmed. They were parked on the shoulder of the highway. Bernie wasn't in the car. She needed a moment to locate him in the darkness, a few steps off the road, his back to her, urinating. When he returned to the car and saw her awake, he said,
Sorry. Prostate like a cantaloupe. If you need lady facilities, we'll be fueling in El Paso in 40 minutes.
No, I'm good. She closed her eyes as he took a foil-wrapped hand wipe from a supply in the console box and tore it open. The fragrance of lemons. As she fell asleep, she wondered if they were close enough to El Paso that cell service was good. But if he'd had his phone when he got out of the car, who could he have called? He hadn't turned her over to the police at the roadblock when he'd had the chance. She had to trust him. Controlled paranoia was a survival mechanism. Unrelieved paranoia was a greased chute into madness. As if drugged, Jane slept undisturbed during the fuel stop in El Paso. Chapter 6. Sometime in the night, Jolie Tillman half woke, still oppressed by exhaustion. The hotel room lay quiet. She listened for Twyla's breathing in the bed beside her, but didn't hear it. The lamp had been turned off. Because they hadn't closed the draperies at the windows, moon glow and ambient rays from the lamplit streets were admitted, the palest of light faintly fingering the surfaces of everything, as if the ghost of a blind man had come to haunt by touch what he had never seen in life. If Twyla hadn't been wearing white pajamas, which attracted the phantom light, Jolie would not have seen her in the armchair where she sat facing the bed. Twyla might have been sleeping, though her posture seemed to be that of someone alert in the gloom. A cowl of shadow concealed her face, and if her eyes were fixed on Jolie, no glimmer of reflection confirmed her stare. The figure was so deathly still in the stillness of the room that Jolie was not convinced of her own wakefulness. She closed her eyes and opened them and closed them and opened them again. And the occupant of the armchair did not fluidify and flow away as it might have in a sleeper's fancy. But weariness weighed down on Jolie, and her leaden eyelids closed and did not open, so that the question, reality or dream, went unanswered. Chapter 7. With a crick in her neck and a sour taste in her mouth, Jane woke to the bass purr of an engine. No Lawrence Welk. She opened her eyes as day was breaking across grasslands low between two mountain ranges, early sun tracing volcanic slopes to broken crests softened by millions of years of erosion and swales of forest. Bernie Rigowitz had made good time to El Paso and across the southwest corner of New Mexico into Arizona, about 300 miles in less than 4 hours. As Jane powered her seat into an upright position, Bernie said, "You slept like a kitten full up with cream." "Yeah. Well, I feel like a cat that's been fighting all night."
"Say we stop in Wilcox for gas and breakfast. Say you take the wheel from there. We can make Nogales by 10 o'clock, 11.
Massaging the back of her neck, she said, "I'm not sure about the we part. My plan was to put you out somewhere on the south side of Tucson and make the last hour to Nogales on my own before any stolen car report you filed could be a worry." His smile sagged in the sad clown folds of his face, but then he declared,
"Schmonsus! Are we partners here, or are we partners?"
"We've never been partners, Bernie."
"Then what have we been, I ask you?"
"Kidnapped and kidnapper."
"Are you going for crazy here? Do I look kidnapped? You thumbed a ride, I give a ride, we're in a thing here."
"The man in Nogales is dangerous."
"I know from danger. All my life I've had IRS up my tuchus."
"You're forgetting this," she said, drawing her pistol.
"Again with the gun. We're past guns, if you haven't noticed."
She thought about it a while. "This guy in Nogales is expecting me Saturday. Just me. When you do business with him, he doesn't want you bringing your grandfather. I need to call him, move up the meet. But I'll need a story. You can't be Bernie Rigowitz, king of wigs."
"I never said king. Tacky. We'll be in Wilcox in 40 minutes. They have a Best Western. We'll cook up a story over breakfast."
"You leave the cooking to me." She considered the situation in Nogales for a few minutes. If she took the Mercedes there without Bernie, she'd have to leave it for Enrique to ship to Mexico when she left in her new wheels. She knew Bernie too well now to jack his car and swap it to Enrique. She said, "Do you have a hat?"
"Absolutely. Do I have a head? I've got hats."
"If you've got a hat that works, then we have a story."
"The story is a hat?"
"The story depends on how you look in the hat, and everything depends on you doing exactly and only what I tell you to do."
"I would give you trouble?" "I wouldn't. This will be fun."
"It won't be fun, but it'll be interesting. And we could end up in a shitstorm." Chapter 8. Whether or not Twyla spent part of the night in the armchair, She was in bed when she rose at 5 o'clock Friday morning. The little disruption that she caused was enough to wake Jolie, who watched her sister through slitted eyes as she took her purse from the nightstand and went into the bathroom. Twyla had never been inconsiderate, but for all her grace, she had always been a noisy girl. Noisier than this. The care with which she eased out of bed, picked up her purse, and closed the bathroom door behind her were out of character and suggested an intention to deceive. Jolie slid from the bed even more quietly than Twyla had, eased around the foot of it, and put one ear to the bathroom door, in time to hear the soft tones as her sister entered a number on her phone. Whoever she called must have answered, and she did not identify herself before saying, "I was supposed to call you this morning, but I can't remember why." After a pause, she said, "All right." Another pause. "We're driving to Indianapolis to meet someone. I don't know who or where. My mother will call my father when we're almost there." Pause. "Okay. Yes, I will. Just a second." In the bathroom, Twyla turned on the water in the sink. Jolie could hear her sister still talking on the phone, but the sound of rushing water splashing into the porcelain bowl prevented her from understanding what was being said. Which was why Twyla cranked on the water in the first place. She wasn't washing her hands and conducting a phone conversation at the same time, and whoever was at the other end of the line had told her to do it. Jolie stepped away from the bathroom door and sat in the armchair from which her sister had, or had not, watched her sleeping in the night. Sight unseen, knowing nothing but his first name, she didn't like this Charles character. What kind of boyfriend wanted his girl to report on her family in such a sneaky fashion? For what reason? And why would Twyla do it? Jolie decided it was time to open Twyla's suitcase again and take out the drugs and syringes, go to Mother with the evidence, and with all the details of Twyla's curious behavior. However, as the faucet in the sink was shut off and the water in the shower came on, she decided that it was almost time to go to Mother, but not quite. 17 years of sibling love and only good-natured rivalry, 17 years of laughter and mutual dreaming, and more hours of girl talk than could be counted, had woven a bond between them that, if not sacred, was certainly hallowed and pure and genuine, a bond not to be strained or broken lightly. She owed Twyla the chance to reconsider whatever she was doing. When they got to Indianapolis, and Mother received further directions from Daddy, if then Twyla seemed in a sweat to get somewhere private and make a phone call, Jolie would rat her out. That's what it would be, sad to say. Ratting out Twyla would be a terrible thing, a relationship-damaging thing. But it wouldn't be as bad as Twyla, on some exotic drug, ratting out the rest of the family for God knows what purpose. Chapter 9. Enrique de Soto, car salesman without a sign or an advertising budget, maintained his showroom in a series of barns on a former horse ranch near Nogales, Arizona. The barns weren't as old as they appeared to be. Enrique and his men antiqued them to suggest the property belonged to a family at the end of several generations of bad luck. The front barn was weathered gray with crusted black-brown inlays that suggested rotten wood, mottled with eczema-like patches of faded red paint from a distant age of prosperity. In the event that any person of authority not on Enrique's graft list stopped for a look-in, this barn closest to the county road was stocked with the sorriest collection of antiques in the Southwest, as if the De Soto family was a pack of delusional hoarders for whom the words antiques and junk were synonyms and whose customers shared their delusion. While Jane stood inside the double-wide doorway with the owner, waiting for her new wheels to be brought around, Enrique stared in fascination at the elderly man behind the wheel of the Mercedes. Bernie Rigowitz wore a snap-brimmed hat with a round, flat crown, a pork pie hat that had been popular with certain tough guys, at least since the days of Prohibition. The engine of the E-350 was running, air conditioning on, windows closed, and Bernie stared straight forward, a hard look on his face, as if being here was beneath him, considering that it was such a small potatoes criminal enterprise.
"Sure, I heard some about Meyer Lansky," Enrique said. "Who never heard about Meyer Lansky? Biggest Jew mob boss ever. They call him something different in those Godfather movies. But this dude, he's not Meyer Lansky. Meyer Lansky, he was dead before I was born."
"I didn't say he was Meyer Lansky. I'm not into voodooing up dead mobsters. I said he's bigger than Meyer Lansky." Enrique was a hard man who would kill if absolutely necessary, but he had a sweet, boyish face and the unimposing physical presence of a jockey. He clearly liked the idea that a big-time crime boss could be as diminutive as the collection of dewlaps and wrinkles wearing a pork pie hat and waiting sternly in the Mercedes.
"But I never heard about some new Jew mob boss."
"You won't have," Jane said. "And he's not new, Ricky. Does he look new? He's been king behind the scenes for 40 years.
"So what's his name?"
"You don't want to know. He wouldn't want you to. Once you know, nothing good can happen for you. The big mistake Lansky and those other wise guys made was wanting to be known, admired, feared. To this man's way of thinking, being known is inviting trouble." Enrique favored her with a heavy-lidded, sideways look.
"You bullshitting me? How's he do business? Nobody knows his name."
"I didn't say nobody knew it. The people who need to know it, they know it. But that's a pretty tight circle."
"Dude like him don't travel with some gun muscle?"
"What do you think I am?"
"Yeah, okay. But if he's who you say, what's he doing here? He want a bite from my apple? Nobody gets a bite from my apple."
"Relax, Ricky. I mean no offense when I say this, so don't go all Latin temper on me. But this man here wouldn't find your little operation worth his time. It's chicken shit to him. He makes deals in the tens and hundreds of millions. He's here because he's with me. We've been doing business. We have mutual respect. We go way back."
"You go way back? So how old are you? 15?
She laughed and put one hand on his shoulder and squeezed and said, "You know how to melt a girl's resistance, Ricky. Way back for me is 5 years. Listen, you know who I am, right?"
"Everybody knows you these days. I wish you didn't give up your old look, though. I like your old look."
When Marcus Paul Hedzman, the serial killer, had been caught in a car stolen from Enrique, when he had tried to sell out this specialist in pre-owned vehicles, and when the FBI had been too busy to care about DeSoto's enterprise, Enrique had been surprised to be able to stay in business unmolested. When Jane first came to him for wheels, the Ford Escape was their second transaction, she'd given him the impression that she deep-sixed the file on him to make sure he remained a free man. Enrique knew zip about law enforcement personnel shortages and the prosecutorial overload that required a triage approach to selecting which crimes to punish. Instead, he liked to think a good-looking FBI agent took such a shine to him that she blinded the eye of the law to his very existence. "Listen," she said, "you know every Jake and gumshoe dick in the country is looking for me. Why do you think they can't put their hands on little old me, one girl on the run?" Enrique stared once more at the man in the Mercedes.
"Because you got connections like him."
"There you go."
"Where's the Ford Escape I sold you, like, not 3 weeks ago?"
"It got on a hot sheet. I parked it along a highway in Texas with a trooper cuffed to the door. He pulled me over, so I had to chain him to slow him down while I took his patrol car for a ride. Enrique smiled and shook his head.
Girl, you're pedal to the metal headed for a cement wall.
Negative thinking brings negative results.
Thinking positive won't never change cement to cardboard.
A guy arrived in a metallic gray Ford Explorer Sport. It's got thunder? She asked. Enrique opened the hood.
Know what you're looking at?
A purpose-built 502 Chevy. 700 horsepower or more.
825. Bendix aluminum cylinder heads. Pair of Edelbrock 650 CFM 4 barrels with an MSD ignition. Pops a 250 shot of nitrous oxide in the fuel mix. Turbo 400 transmission with gear vendors overdrive. It's a monster.
You had to do body work to get all that in there.
Ripped out the navigation system. Clean papers. New, off the lot, with no improvements. They'd take you for $46,000.
She closed the hood. Except it didn't cost you anything.
Paid $1,400 to the dude who boosted it new. $400 more to get it to Mexico for a redo. Then the improvements.
Mostly made with stolen parts that cost you nothing.
Don't cut off my cojones. You know, labor isn't free.
We already bargained, Ricky. I'm not trying to renegotiate. She opened her handbag and gave him the $28,000 in $100 bills to which they had agreed on the phone.
Papers and keys are in it. Plus, a nice little air freshener. It's shaped like a puppy. The flower smell comes out of his butthole.
Your customer service is unparalleled. When she started around to the driver's door, he put a hand on her arm.
Say I do something nice for you. Will you tell the Jew about it?
Depends on whether I agree it's something nice. He peeled $3,000 off the money she had given him and returned it to her.
A little discount in honor of the man.
Tucking the money in her handbag, she said, That's very generous of you, Ricky.
Be sure you tell him my name.
I will. I'll tell him. As she opened the driver's door of the Explorer, Enrique said,
Try to keep this one more than 3 weeks. You can't be spending so much on cars. You should listen to Dave Ramsey on the radio. Get with his budget plan.
Chapter 10. Given the trajectory of recent events, Jolie Tillman figured they were sliding into some horrific circumstance. In fact, the angle and slipperiness of the slope were steadily increasing. She sensed a growing momentum that made her queasy. They didn't get out of Lake Forest as early as they meant to, and they didn't entirely escape the Chicago rush hour, and they stopped for breakfast in a town called Merrillville, where Jolie ordered waffles with whipped cream and syrup and butter, plus a glass of chocolate milk. She didn't usually eat so badly, but she was in a mood that only a lot of sugar and animal fat might cure. Everyone seemed to be in a mood this morning. Twyla, of course, was either hooked on some exotic illegal drug or fending off a life-threatening condition with medication, might be pregnant, was in the thrall of and being manipulated by the devious Charles C. Charles of the infamous Charles family, so the fact that she was brooding and quiet was no surprise. Naturally, Mother was worried because she didn't know where Daddy was, because she and her children were on the run from the kind of people who had tattoos of snakes eating their own tails, and because maybe their lives were never going to be the same again, which explained why her usually smooth brow was now continuously lined like wide whale corduroy, and why she didn't care to pass the time in frivolous conversation. The trip was therefore tedious, but they arrived in the fabled city of Indianapolis, and at precisely 10:51 a.m., Twyla used the disposable phone to input Daddy's burner number and then handed it to Mother while it was ringing, so that Mother could break the law by driving with a cell phone in hand. As it turned out, Daddy didn't yet know when they would be met by his emissary. Everything remained in flux, so he wanted them to go to Courtyard by Marriott on Fortune Circle and get a room if one was available for early check-in, there to wait to be contacted by James Bond or the equivalent.